Sounds True presents The Field with award-winning author and investigative journalist Lynn McTaggart.
Hi, this is Lynn McTaggart. Welcome to my program. I'm going to tell you about a journey that I took, and it started with my job. I'm the editor of a newsletter called What Doctors Don't Tell You, and I look at alternative and conventional medicine, and I study medical literature to determine what works and what doesn't. And in the course of that, about 8 years ago, I kept coming up with good, solid evidence that things like acupuncture and homeopathy and spiritual healing work. And this absolutely blew my mind, because I thought, if there's good solid evidence that this stuff works, that it must mean that the scientific paradigm that we now have about the way the universe works is wrong or incomplete. So I went to my publisher and I talked them into financing a journey that I would take to try to find out if any scientists out there could explain to me why this stuff works. So I traveled around the world on a quest to speak to many scientists who were working in a variety of areas, physics, biology, chemistry, to see if they had a piece of the puzzle. And also to see if they had some grand theory that would explain why things like distant healing work. And it soon occurred to me that there was no grand theory out there to explain this, and that the scientists I did find had uncovered some remarkable things about the nature of reality, but that they'd only found one tiny element of it. And it began to feel like they'd all discovered a little bucket of Earth, but nobody was bold enough to declare it a continent. What's usually the case with scientists is that they do experimental work, and they are told not to move outside their own theory or their own experimental evidence, and so it's very difficult for them to speculate. So it quickly became apparent that if I wanted a theory, a big grand theory of everything, I was going to have to come up with it myself. Now, the most daunting prospect of this is that I'm not a physicist. In fact, I'm not any kind of scientist. The last kind of science I ever studied was in the 10th grade. But what I am fairly good at is reporting. I have a background in investigative reporting. So I felt that what I might be able to do is tease out of these scientists enough information to try to knit this together myself. So that is what I did, and it was a very difficult prospect. It was probably the hardest thing I've ever done. I had to be tutored by many of these scientists, and I had to try to help them to communicate with me in a way that I could understand. I also had to study quantum physics, which was very mind-boggling because it's so counterintuitive. Many of the very strange effects of quantum physics make no sense in the real world. And for the scientists to describe quantum physics for me was equally difficult. I often had to feed back to them what they were trying to say to me in metaphor to see if that could explain in language what they were trying to relate through equations and mathematics. As I talked to the scientists, as they tutored me in quantum physics, what became apparent to me was that quantum physics, as it's now constructed, looks at the very, very tiny or the very, very large in terms of the universe, but doesn't look at the human element. In fact, humans are left out of quantum theory because the current view is that the human body, anything living, does not have a quantum process within it. And so I was really asking, are we quantum entities? Do quantum processes go on inside of us? Do we relate to each other with frequencies, not as separate beings? And What does that mean to our worldview? Well, it became apparent to me in talking to these scientists was that what they were looking at and what they were discovering and what I was going to look at and try to put together was going to threaten science as we know it, which is basically Newtonian science. Everything that we believe about our world and how it works is derived from the views of Isaac Newton, which were developed in the 17th century. And these views basically paint a world that is very well behaved, that works according to very fixed rules, but that is also a world inhabited by separate objects in space and time. And from those theories about this well-behaved universe, we've constructed a worldview of the separate. We believe that we are individual and lonely beings on a lonely planet in a lonely universe. And that informs how we create our work, how we teach our children, how we live our lives. As I mentioned earlier, one of the big problems was there was no grand theory out there. I was going to have to construct it from the little pieces of the puzzle that each of these scientists offered. And it became apparent to me as I did so that what I was looking at was a radical new view of the world that described a completely different way of how our world works, of how we work and how we define ourselves. It came about from frontier scientists who had asked a couple of questions that were important about what hadn't been completed in quantum theory. They also asked the obvious question, why are there two kinds of physics? These days, there's the physics of the small, which is the physics of quantum physics, and the physics of the very large. That's the big observable world out there. And most physicists are content to believe that quantum particles behave one way when they're on their own as a tiny particle, but behave entirely differently as a part of a collective whole, as a big thing. So these scientists were brave enough to ask those questions, you know, can nature be this messy and redundant to have two kinds of physics? They also were looking at things like, what is consciousness? Where is it? Is it in the brain? And they wondered about our role and the role of consciousness and whether it can extend out and affect its world. And later in this program, I'll be looking at the individual contributions of these scientists. I realized in trying to put all their material together that I was looking at a new paradigm of the universe that was underpinned by a dynamic cobweb of information encoded in an energy field that connected everything in its invisible web, and that the universe existed as a relationship. It wasn't a collection of individual things on this lonely planet and this lonely universe, but it was about things affecting other things at every moment. I also realized that we, as conscious beings, we're at the very center of this process as creators of our own universe. And that maybe there wasn't an out there anymore, that out there was all part of me, and that we were all an integral part of this information exchange. The other question they asked concerned the so-called observer effect in quantum theory. And this is the well-known effect in all quantum experiments. It has to do with the fact that quantum particles are not one set thing. Any quantum entity is all of its possible selves all at the same time. It's a little bit like something being, instead of an individual seat, the entire stadium. Or it's like looking at yourself in a hall of mirrors. It's all possible selves all at the same time. And all quantum physicists know that this unreconstructed thing becomes a set thing as soon as someone observes it or takes a measurement. But few scientists ever ask the question of whether or not the observer effect occurs in real life. Does this mean that all of reality exists in this kind of unconstructed state and that we create our reality as we observe it? This was a really difficult process for me because it was like pulling a little piece of string and finding a bit more and then going a bit further and a bit further. I would start with one scientist and he would tell me some pretty amazing things, but then there'd be a lot of other questions I would have from that, and I would have to think a bit more about, well, okay, where does that lead me? And then I would have to follow on from there and say, right, and how does that work in the human body? And then if that's the case, what does this mean about cell communication? Or what does this mean about how our brains work? And is the mind encased inside the brain, as most neuroscientists would say? And what does this mean about our extended human potential? And so it became more and more of a string pulling exercise until I felt I had enough material to start assembling it. The other really difficult thing about this was that these guys talk in code. If you've ever talked to a quantum physicist, you'll understand that their method of communicating with each other is through math. They write equations. And so for them to say this in language that's understandable to a non-scientist like me was very difficult. I had to, in many cases, talk to them in analogies. I'd have to say to them things like, if I understand you correctly, it's like this. And I would create a metaphor. And they would have to say, yeah, it's a bit like that. And so that's how we got to talk to each other. We talked to each other in metaphors. But I was also conscious of being a non-scientist. I am also a very careful reporter. And I wanted to make sure what I was saying was correct. So when I finished writing, I sent relevant portions back to all of the scientists to carefully check to make sure that what I'd turned into plain layman's English was also correct. One of the first things I had to think about was how to start and where to start. And many people that I came across all pointed to Edgar Mitchell. Now, Mitchell is an American hero and a celebrity. He was the sixth man on the moon and one of the crew members of Apollo 14. He narrowly escaped being on Apollo 13. And in fact, if you've seen the movie, he was the guy in the simulator who helped to bring the module back after it had had its fire. Mitchell had an experience, and his experience really informed me about what I was looking for, because I hadn't even known where to start, or when I was first doing this, I didn't even know what I was looking for. Mitchell had had an amazing experience when he was in outer space and on coming home from landing on the moon. He was in the little Kitty Hawk, which was circulating around, and he was looking through the window, looking at Earth. And while he was there, he had this, what could only be described as an epiphany, a feeling that he was reaching out through the cosmos and every molecule in his being was connected with everything else. And he felt himself extending out, almost like he was extending out through the window. And he had this image and a total sense of connectivity. It wasn't a spiritual feeling. It wasn't like he'd seen the face of God. He just had this utter sense and certainty of connection. And that for me was the kernel of the whole thing. How to find a science that could describe this connection. I was certain that he was right. It was the only way that something like spiritual healing or homeopathy could work. A science that could explain an invisible connection between things. And it was just trying to find a mechanism for what Ed Mitchell had experienced that was the first thing I had to think about in my journey. So I had this idea that I was looking for something, some mechanism for connecting everything in the world, and I didn't know what that might be. And then one scientist just told me as an aside, oh, you must go speak to Hal Puthoff. He has some crazy idea about this thing called the zero-point field. So I phoned Hal. I didn't get a chance to meet him until the following year when we both met in England. That was one of the interesting things about this research. I met people all over the world, and many times, because I live in London, we had to meet at a third country. Hal was an incredibly mild-mannered character. He reminds me of a Clark Kent, one of these people who is very phlegmatic on the exterior. And that posture, in a sense, conceals this amazing, boiling inner world of lateral thinking. He's just one of those classic explorer scientists who thinks about, well, what if, and uses what if to ask the most outrageous questions. And that's one of the interesting things and the fascinating things for me about doing this work is talking with frontier scientists who have to ask these outrageous questions all the time. What if stones fall from the sky? What if you can lift giant metal things and make them fly? That's what propels any kind of advancement, that ability and willingness to ask an outrageous question. And with Hal, the outrageous question really came about during the 70s when America had an oil crisis. His benefactor, Bill Church, had run out of gas and was so angry about it because he had run out of gas on one of those days when you couldn't get gas unless, you know, your license plate had a certain kind of number on the back. So he was fuming and he spoke to Hal and just said, well, what else could we do besides fossil fuel? We need to find an alternative. And that question set Hal off on a really interesting what-if exploration, which was just to say, okay, what else could we do besides fossil fuel? And he thought of all the usual suspects, things like solar power. And then what came to mind was a thing that physicists know about, but have more or less discarded or ignored. It's this thing called the zero-point field. And what it is the energy produced by an energy exchange between subatomic particles. All the subatomic particles in the world operate by passing energy back and forth, almost like an endless game of basketball. They send a basketball over to another particle, the other particle sends it back. And so it goes on between all the subatomic particles in all the things in all the world. So you can imagine how many basketballs are going back and forth. That energy exchange produces little virtual particles that just last for a blink of an eye. But that kind of back and forth energy exchange creates so much energy that if you were sitting a yard away from me, the energy between us would be so much, it'd be enough to boil all the oceans of the world. So that's power, and it occurs in empty space, or so-called empty space. To Hal's mind, this field, and it's a field is like a matrix, it's the mothership, a medium for things to go through. So Hal realized that if he could extract energy from this field, he would have what he called a cosmic free lunch. He'd be able to just have empty space power things. And he started thinking, well, this is not only a great way to power automobiles, but it's a wonderful way to power spaceships to far-off galaxies. Because at the moment, if we were to try to do that, we'd need a rocket as big as the sun to carry all the fossil fuel that would be required to take us that far. So Hal started really thinking about this and working on it. And he actually worked out mathematically, which is how physicists do things, the fact that if you factored in the zero-point field, you could explain all sorts of things that have bedeviled physicists for the longest time. Things like how inertia works or how gravity works. Those are big questions that physicists have never been able to provide a real proving of, a real explanation for. And suddenly, if you factored in the field, it all made sense. The field isn't anything that's mysterious to the ordinary physicist. They've known about it for years, ever since the development of quantum physics. But they've more or less subtracted it out. They figured because it was ever present, it didn't count. They do a thing called renormalizing it. by getting rid of the field, their equations start working. They don't have to go on to infinity. So Hal thought, well, hey, you know, maybe the field is the whole point of the story. Maybe what they've been subtracting out is the whole important bit. So he started thinking about this, and then he also realized something almost as a sideline, because Hal is a frontier physicist, but he looks into questions of astrospace and things like that, but he's a very orthodox physicist. So these were just things he was contemplating in his more private moments. He kept thinking, well, you know, there's a metaphysical implication here with the field, because the field as a mothership of all energy produced from quantum particles in the world, the field is almost like a repository of all information. Because the important thing to know about quantum particles or quantum waves, because a particle is also a wave, is that it's an encoder of information. When two waves bump into each other, they exchange information, so they take on the information of the other. So if you have that in a giant field, you have almost like a shadow of the universe. You've got all the information that's ever been. So Hal started thinking, well, gee, maybe you could manipulate this field. Maybe we could send certain information out to it. And there was also a bigger implication, which was, if the field is connecting everything via their subatomic particles, then at the nethermost level of our being, we must be connected with everything else in the world. Hal also had some private thoughts about the field. In his private moments, he kept thinking to himself that the field is an interesting mechanism for explaining a number of things. First of all, if the field exists and everything is part of this field, it might be true that consciousness can manipulate this field and create certain ordered structures in it. It also might be the case that it would be a mechanism to explain a number of things. He thought a bit about cases of levitation that had no other explanation other than manipulating some force. He thought perhaps this is a bit like the force in Star Wars. And he also thought about it being a mechanism for connecting everything together. Now, once I'd heard that, and I started talking to Hal and then talking to some of his other colleagues, people like Bernie Haish out in California, as they started talking, it was like a giant light bulb had gone on in me. I suddenly realized, now, to the layperson like me, to the non-physicist, this was the mechanism. This was the perfect explanation for how things like spiritual healing and homeopathy and acupuncture could possibly work. Here was the way that we would all be connected, that information from one set of thoughts could be sent to somebody else and have it affect them instantaneously. So I realized with Hal, I had found my mechanism. I had found a way to describe how this worked. And I then had to just see if everything else could fit together with this. One of the problems, though, having to do with quantum physics the way it is now cast, is that according to most orthodox physicists, quantum physics only applies to the non-living. Biological systems of any kind, any living systems, including us and plants and anything else like that, supposedly don't have quantum processes in them. So for my theory to work, it would have to mean that I'd have to find information and evidence that we and every other living thing are also a quantum process. So that became my next search. So if Hal was right and this field was going to connect everything we were connected with too, it would have to be the case that our subatomic particles were also swapping energy with the field, and that our consciousness, our minds were also communicating through frequencies, and our body somehow talking to itself and the rest of the field in terms of quantum processes too. And the problem I had was that no orthodox physicist was saying this was going on. So I wondered, well, I don't know how I'm going to prove something like this. So in discussing with some of the scientists, they pointed out fairly late in the game that I want to speak to a guy called Fritz Albert Popp, who's in Germany. So to find Fritz, we corresponded, and then I met him in northern England during a conference that he was attending. And when he started speaking, I realized that everything that was suggested by the field was definitely the case with his discoveries. Fritz was, again, an orthodox physicist. He was very interested in light. Some 30 years ago, he was playing around with light, and he found that certain substances that were carcinogenic, when he shined ultraviolet light on them, they would take that and they would scramble the frequencies. Something in them were frequency scramblers. And he was puzzled by this. And then he started thinking about some other processes in the body, and he kept thinking, well, maybe this is what causes cancer, that these things mess around with our own frequencies. But, of course, to have an effect, it would mean that we somehow had light in our bodies that these chemicals could change. So he presented his material, and he was completely laughed at because people said, well, there is no light in the body. So he was working with one of his students who was particularly good at creating equipment, and he said, well, okay, you can work with me if you can find light in the body. So his student, Bernard, created this strange contraption that he claimed could count light photon by photon. Now, a photon is the tiniest particle of light. It is to light what an electron is to an atom. It's just a tiniest particle of it. And Bernard got this machine together that actually could count these photons. So when they started putting potatoes in and cucumber seedlings and little living things like that in, they discovered, lo and behold, that there was this tiny current of light coming out of these living things. And it was just astonishing to them. But Pop began to think about this and figured this must be a really important mechanism in the body. It must be the way the body talks to itself. It might be the central conductor, because that is one of the big problems we have now in biology, and that hasn't really been addressed in orthodox biology, is who orchestrates all the processes in our body. I mean, think about the millions and millions and millions and millions of cells in our body, all manufacturing all sorts of things all at the same time. I mean, the typical body is like a manufacturing plant covering most of the United States. That's how much is going on all the time. So Pop thought, well, maybe this light is being sent out of some central place and it's telling our bodies what to do all the time. It might also be able to explain another thing that's been a great conundrum for physicists, which is how little cells take shape. Because when we think of ourselves, when we're first conceived, we're just a single cell. And that starts differentiating very, very quickly. And certain cells know to become arms, and certain cells know to become legs. So Pop thought, well, maybe this is the way that the body tells itself to differentiate. So he began starting looking a bit more, and he found, lo and behold, this light was mainly coming out of the DNA of the cells. This DNA was like a little radio station beaming out instructions. He also began to study it in human beings, and he found that there were certain periodic changes that were going on, that there would be different levels of light on different days, and also different levels depending on how healthy the person was. So if somebody was very healthy, they had a certain constant level. If they had multiple sclerosis or something like that, they might have too much light. They might have too many emissions. if somebody had cancer, it was like their light was going out. They were sending out too little light. So Pop realized that this had a great function, but it might have another function too. And he wanted to see whether or not there was any kind of communication going on between organisms. He carried out a number of studies of what he was beginning to call biophoton emissions, a nice big sciencey term for this little current of light going on. And he discovered that things like fleas or other plants were signaling to each other all the time. They were sending information that was being picked up and replied to by another organism, and that this was going on all around the environment, that an egg was communicating with its shell, that a string bean, when you cut it in half, one part would start communicating with the other, that fleas would talk to each other in distance, and they were all communicating through this light. So once again, this said to me that, first of all, we were a quantum process, that we had these kinds of quantum things going on in ourselves, but also that this was a very, very highly ordered kind of light. One thing that Pop discovered that was quite amazing, according to ordinary physics, is that this light was highly coherent. Now, coherence is a weird term in physics, and I nearly wanted to cry trying to figure out what it actually meant. Pop had to spend a lot of time tutoring me into understanding it, and even then I had to use metaphors to really explain it. So one of the metaphors I like to use is, it's like a well-rehearsed marching band. Ordinarily, light, like from an ordinary light bulb, is very disordered. And by that I mean that each light wave has a different kind of phase. And by that they mean, if you think of a light wave, think of a jump rope held by two people and wiggled at both ends. And so you've got a wavy line, almost like a sideways S. And if two waves are in phase, that means they're both waving up and down at the same time. That's called constructive interference. That means they bump into each other and they're both waving up and down at the same time in sync. If they're destructive, it means they're waving at different up and downs and they cancel each other out. Ordinarily, with a light bulb, a lot of the waves destructively interfere, so they cancel each other out. With a coherent system, though, all the waves are waving in sync, like a well-rehearsed marching band, as I say, or even a bit like an orchestra. Each retain their individuality, but they together contribute to the collective sound. So this kind of coherence has only been discovered in systems that are cooled down to a few degrees below absolute zero, really cold, special conditions. Those are the only ways that physicists these days have been able to see this with our current instrumentation. But what Pop was discovering was that these highly coherent quantum waves were occurring in this little hot living thing, something that physicists have all said just doesn't occur. He realized that this kind of remarkable property of coherence, which allows for much greater communication, much stronger effects, occurs in biological systems. Another way to think about coherence is a quite interesting thing, going back to our light bulb again. With an ordinary light bulb, those disordered waves don't produce that much light. Let's say we have a 60-watt light bulb. But if you had a coherent 60-watt light bulb, you would have light that would be hundreds of thousands of times brighter than the surface of the sun. That's how powerful coherence is. So again, I started thinking with Pop's material, the idea that we could find this kind of property in human beings and other living things suggested to me that our consciousness had this remarkable power, and that maybe when we're coherent, we can shine as bright as the sun too. I think what was most remarkable about Pop's discoveries is that they provided a description of what might be going on with things like intention. Maybe intention is nothing more than coherent light. Maybe what's happening is that this light has got a instant connection through the zero-point field with other things, and one highly targeted thought is enough to connect it. One other thing that I had to think about and consider when I was trying to look at a mechanism for all of this was the idea that when healers send healing, they can do it over vast distances. They can do it over thousands and thousands of miles. And some of the effects are instantaneous. And that kind of an effect just can't be described in our current physics because we have an absolute limiting factor in the speed of light. Nothing is supposed to be traveling faster than the speed of light. So here were effects going on almost instantaneously. One mechanism that might account for these effects is a thing in quantum physics called non-locality, or it's also referred to poetically as entanglement. What it actually means is once two quantum particles have been in contact, you could move them very far away. You could move one to Tokyo and the other to New York, and they would act as though they were a little bit like twins separated at birth. Even though you'd move them that far apart, they'd both like the color blue, they'd both marry a woman called Jane, and if one fell down and broke his leg, the other one would fall down and break his leg at the exact same moment, even if he was nowhere near stairs and he was just sitting on a stool drinking a cup of coffee. So that kind of constant effect on each other, where they're both aware of each other and acting in exactly the same or opposite way, is like an instant connection over gigantic amounts of space. And it only occurs, so physicists say, in the world of the tiny, in the world of the very small, the quantum world. So maybe these quantum effects, like non-locality, occur in biological systems, like us, over vast distances, and in the world of the everyday. Since Papa demonstrated to me that there was this little two-way communication system going on between things, I thought perhaps things like non-locality would demonstrate that this dialogue was not only ongoing, but instantaneous, that between all the things in the world, there could be an instantaneous connection. One of the things I most admire about these scientists is the fact that they had to struggle so much against the orthodoxy to carry on this research. I mean, even though when we think of scientists, we think of explorers, very few of them are real explorers. Most scientists have a lot of pressure on them to just continue to confirm the orthodoxy, confirm the kinds of ideas we already have. And so there are only a few brave souls out there who do true exploring. And in every instance, the men and women that I met were real explorers in the sense that they had started out their careers being very orthodox and then stumbled across something that just didn't fit. And they were brave enough to examine that, even if it derailed many of their future plans. And in people like Pop, it certainly did. Pop was treated in a lot of ways like a criminal, and he lost his job at his university, and for a while was out of work. Luckily, a number of other scientists around the world finally caught up with him and his ideas, and he's now well-respected, and there's some 40 scientists around the world doing his work in studying and counting this living light. But for a long time, he was a terrible outcast. And one has to really admire the bravery of these people to put everything on the line for truth. So I discovered one person who believed that our bodies are a quantum process. But he had been left wondering if any other scientists could find some other evidence that what was going on in our body was not just electrical signaling and chemicals. And I was left with the need to find more evidence about these quantum processes in the body and this kind of frequency signaling. Ultimately, I found that in France. I heard about a scientist called Jacques Benveniste, who had done these amazing studies that were called the Memory of Water studies. And they were widely regarded as being a proving of homeopathy. And like so many things, like Pop's work and like Hal Puthoff's work, it was a kind of happy accident. I mean, Benveniste was a orthodox biologist who specialized in allergies, and he was applauded by the French government and had a special position in a place called INSERM, which is the highest national organization, almost like the National Institutes of Health in France. He was even regarded as somebody who was a possibility for the Nobel Prize. But one day, his lab assistant came to him and said, I've done this experiment that you asked, and the experiment was just to try to see how a certain allergen affected white blood cells. And she said, I realized I diluted the water too much, and yet I still got the same result. And he said, don't be ridiculous, you're just experimenting with water. He sent her back to do it again. But he was sufficiently intrigued, and he said, okay, let's dilute it a lot and see what happens. And he continued to do that until there was virtually none of the original substance left. And he found he still had the same chemical reaction as if the original substance was there. So he formalized it, and he did a bunch of studies testing this idea of doing high, high dilutions to the point where there was no molecule left. So he carried out a batch of studies doing high dilutions of the original substance and discovered that he was getting these good effects. No matter how well he diluted the substance, he was getting an effect. He published his material in a prestigious scientific journal, but it really sparked something else, and this something else was what I was intrigued by. He thought, if I can dilute something so much that none of the original molecule remains, but I can still have a chemical process with it, then something about that original substance has a unique energetic frequency, and that gets stored in water. And that's what he began looking at by using a lot of equipment that could isolate and, in a sense, record the sound of that molecule. And he found that it was true that each molecule had its own signature frequency, and that these were likely to be the thing that was driving the body's processes. And he was able to make these recordings and then play them to another chemical, and the chemical would react as though it was in the presence of the other chemical. And he even did this with some very dramatic and flamboyant experiments. He tried taping these sounds and sending them across the internet via email to one of his colleagues. He tried another kind when he recorded it on a floppy disk and sent it in the post. So he understood that these frequencies are likely to be the main communication system between the cells of our bodies, and that once again, the cells of our body were talking to each other, not just through chemistry, but through quantum waves. I think what was important for me about all of this was understanding that what was going on in our body was a complex kind of communication system powered by frequency and not chemistry. And this makes a lot of sense if you think about the usual chemical reaction in a cell. Every cell in your body is like a swimming pool, and inside there are little chemicals that are the size of a couple of tennis balls. And for them to have a chemical reaction, you'd have to have those two tennis balls bump into each other in the swimming pool. So you can see how long that's going to take, and it certainly doesn't account for the instantaneous reaction that goes on in our bodies every time we experience, say, an emotion like joy or upset. We have an immediate cascade of effects. And this kind of idea of frequency made much more sense to me. And it certainly gave me more evidence for how this might account for our connection via this field, that maybe we were having a dialogue inside our bodies and outside our bodies at the same time. From Benveniste's material, I also realized that all frequencies may not be equal, and that each of our interactions may create a different relationship to enhance or detract. I discovered this through some really interesting information from Benvenista about a robot he had been using to carry out his experiments. A lot of his work had been replicated by a number of other labs, but Benvenista wanted to ensure that they did it properly, so he created a robot to carry out the experiments so it would be completely automated. But he found that with this robot, it would mostly work perfectly, except in the presence of a certain lab technician of his who was a woman. And this was very funny to me because Benvenista was a charming chauvinist when I met him. And he was of the opinion that it would be criminal not to flirt, I mean, as a Frenchman. So he was a charming and harmless chauvinist. But he found that there was a problem with this one woman. And in his mind, he said, cherchez la femme, look to the woman, that she is somehow a frequency scrambler. So he thought, well, maybe I need to put an electromagnetic shield around this robot and then it'll work. But when he did, the robot stopped working altogether. So he thought, well, maybe some people detract from this robot, but other people also enhance it. So he got hold of the guy who had actually built the robot for him, and he said, you stand in front of it. So he did, and the robot worked perfectly. So Benvenista decided to try one more thing, since he'd found that water had been so good at recording these frequencies. He had the inventor hold a little vial of water in his pocket, and then he took that vial, he put it next to the robot, he put the electromagnetic shield around it, and from then on, it worked perfectly 100% of the time. Of course, this kind of information also told me that even computers feel us and that we have an effect on even inanimate things around us. I certainly find that I have an effect. If I'm in a bad mood, I start breaking every machine around me. And I have even been escorted off of the premises of my own company when I start breaking computers and photocopiers. Benvenista was another one of those scientists who had suffered at the hands of the establishment just for pursuing a novel idea. And it was outrageous for somebody of his position. When I went to see him, I met him at a porta cabin, and that's where he was operating. He'd been drummed out of Inserm. His material was held up to ridicule in the scientific journals, and he had to carry on with his scientific investigations with private funding. But there he was. He was determined to carry on with his research. And he had some going there while I was there. He was doing some work on guinea pig hearts. So he was another one of those brave people who understood that he'd uncovered something incredible about the nature of the universe, and it would have been criminal for him to not carry on with it. So far, I had a medium, the zero-point field. I had a lot of evidence that there were quantum communications going on in the body. But I had no real definition of what consciousness might be. And certainly that was the real sticking point. How did this all work? Where were these instructions coming from? If a healer wanted to send an intention to someone else, where was it coming from? I realized that what I was going to have to start looking at was brain research. And somebody, again, suggested that perhaps I talk to Carl Pribram. I thought this might be a difficult situation. He was not an easy person to get hold of, and he didn't like talking to reporters. But I heard that he was going to be in Liège in Belgium, and I went to a mathematics convention just so that I might just bump into him. I hung outside the convention, and as he came out, I introduced myself, and I guess somehow we made some connection, because from there, he let me walk with him while he talked. And Carl Pribram at the time was about 80 years old, and a tiny little Einsteinian elf of a man, but a powerhouse who walked as quickly as he talked. And it was difficult for me to keep up with him both mentally and physically. But he explained as we were walking around Liège his theory and how it had come about. And it was a remarkable story in its own right, because again, it came about by happy accident, by failure, basically. And the failure was what would be considered an outrageous experiment if carried out today. It had to do with rats, and it was the kind of thing that no animal rights activist would allow today. Carl Pribram was working with the great Carl Lashley, who was a neurophysiologist, who was very interested in trying to find out where in the brain memories are stored. So to look at this, he had to look at animals. First, he took these rats and he taught them a simple run. And then he proceeded to damage parts of their brains using the only thing he had at hand, which was his wife's curling iron. But what he discovered was that no matter how much of these brains he destroyed, the rats would have problems with their motor skills, but they would still remember the run. And from that, he concluded, and Pribram did as well, as his apprentice, that there was no precise location for memory, but that it was distributed all over the brain. So Pribram, who was a neurosurgeon, let all of this percolate for some 20 years, and he kept wondering about it, and he wondered about something else, which is, how do we perceive the world? How come the world's out there in 3D when all we're supposed to be doing is seeing a screen? When we see something, we're supposed to see it as a screen on the back of our heads in our retina. How come it's in 3D? And the answer came to him when he read a little article about holography. And that suddenly became the metaphor he was looking for. Maybe it is that our brains find information and pick it up via frequencies and translate all of that into the three-dimensional image that we see. And if this is the case, then maybe our brains are just a transducer that retrieves information from the field and then reads it out. And maybe it is that perception is just good reception at a certain frequency. He also felt that this kind of information gets transformed in the brain. So there's some sort of transformational process that goes on. To understand about Pribram's theories, which were nightmarishly difficult for me to absorb and even to explain, the one thing you need to know is just how a hologram works. In a classic kind of laser hologram, you take a laser beam and you split it. And one portion you reflect off of an object, let's say an apple, and the other is reflected by some mirrors. And then you unite the two together and you capture that image on a piece of photographic film. Now, if you were to just look at that, the result is just a bunch of squiggles or concentric circles. But then if you shine a light beam from the same kind of laser through this film, what you'll get is this incredibly detailed, three-dimensional, ghostly image of the apple. If you've seen the first Star Wars film, you'll remember that image of Princess Leia coming out of R2-D2. That was a hologram. Now, that three-dimensional image is interesting in itself, but probably the most important thing about it is if you took that photographic plate and you cut it up into loads of different pieces and you shone that same light on a tiny little piece of it, you'd see the same full apple out there in space. So the most important thing about a hologram is the fact that the whole is contained in every little part. And that's what Pribram was thinking about too. Pribram realized if there's no precise memory in the brain, it's probably because the information the brain takes in is stored in waveform, and that the brain can contain this as a whole rather than in one particular place. That also would make a lot of sense because when you think about how many memories we have, something like 280 quintillion memories in the average lifespan, where would you put them? If you store things with waves, you can fit an enormous amount of material in a tiny little space. You could take all of the Library of Congress and fit it on a sugar cube. There were some really important elements in Pribram's discoveries, difficult as they were for him to relate to a non-scientist like me. Basically, what was really important was that the brain was a little bit like a television set. It was picking up information sent via broadcasting. And in this case, the broadcaster is the field. So it was a receiver of information and probably a transmitter as well. And also, the other thing that was really important was that in normal reality, the brain responds to just a limited bandwidth of frequencies. Pribram discovered this, and so did other scientists, by doing experiments with animals and humans and finding that we're only responding to a very small amount of frequencies. And this suggested that maybe in moments when we pick up extrasensory information, like when we have precognitive information, you know, when we have forecasting information, or we get images or a sense from something, we know who's on the telephone before we even pick it up. That kind of intuitive information, maybe we're just picking up a wider bandwidth at that point, and we're just tapping into the field a bit more. Edgar Mitchell had come up with another discovery that really set me thinking about the idea that maybe we're looking for a field of some sort here. With some other scientists, he discovered a thing called quantum holography, which was just that all kinds of information about objects, including their three-dimensional shape, is carried in quantum fluctuations. And I thought that to me was almost like a metaphor saying that there's a field of information out there, and embedded in that is information about the world that all of us can tap into under certain conditions. So it was there with that discussion, which was, again, very difficult to interpret, that I had a possible metaphor for what I was looking for. Ed Mitchell's disclosure about quantum holography led me to meet up with Walter Schimpf, another German scientist, this time a mathematics professor who had become an expert on MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, because he felt that he could improve the technology. And as he had been working on MRI and perfecting things, he also discovered that when he took shots of people and he decoded it, that there was all kinds of information about that person, their shape, and all kinds of things embedded in the quantum waves that he'd picked up by his machinery. And that suggested that Carl Pribram was right, that we are picking up stuff in frequency and then creating a hologram of it and creating a three-dimensional image of it, retrieving that information. And it also suggested that what Hal Puthoff had thought about, too, was right, was that this information is all embedded out there in the zero-point field, and we somehow get access to it under certain conditions. When Pribram first formulated his holographic theory, he was out on a limb on his own, but then a number of other scientists began to agree with him. People like Stuart Hameroff, who is an anesthesiologist from the University of Arizona. He started getting involved and working with a British scientist called Roger Penrose, and together they formulated an interesting theory suggesting that the scaffolding of the cell, which is called microtubules, might be something like light pipes, which is the transportation medium for all of the discordant frequencies of the body to get organized into something coherent and sent through the body very quickly, almost like an internet system. Many other scientists around the globe that I heard about and whose papers I read from Japan and many other countries like this, they were beginning to concur that the brain made use of quantum processes. Others put forward the theories that the basis of all the brain's functions had to do with an interaction between the brain's physiology and the zero-point field. Walter Schimpf's discovery about quantum memory in the field suggested the most outrageous idea of all, which many of his fellow scientists agreed with, which is that short and long-term memory may not reside in our brains at all, but might be stored in the zero-point field. And if that's the case, then that would mean that our brains were a retrieval mechanism in every sense, that information may not be there and stored there, and even higher cognitive function may not be in there, but may be out in the field, and that we're just tapping into it when we're locating that information. it would mean that things like memory are just a kind of a cousin of perception, and that when we process information, old information like memory, it's just the same as processing new information. So once I'd finished with Pribram and Shemp and those people, I realized I had my theory that all of this stuff altogether had amazing implications. It had really given me a leap off the end of the universe as we know it, and a new paradigm that looked very different from Newtonian paradigm. It was all about a dynamic cobweb of energy exchange, and that information is encoded and transmitted everywhere at once, and that we're some sort of integral part of this. But it had even bigger implications. Aside from being a stake in the heart of this worldview that we've held, it suggested two things to me. One, our human capability is far greater than we think, that we have an ability to access information that is far greater than we've believed in the past, that all information may be out there and ready for us to access at any moment under certain conditions. And it also suggested something very radical about ourselves, that the boundary lines separating us from other things in the world, the very boundary lines of our individuality, were now blurred. If living things are just one sort of energetic charge interacting with a field and sending out and receiving information, you have to ask, well, where do I end and the rest of the world begin? And where is consciousness? Is it inside my brain, or is it out there in the field? And am I just picking that up, much like a radio or a television set? And in fact, is there any more out there anymore, if we are all one and I'm all part of it? There are lots of other ideas, too, that I'm going to explore in the second part of this program, which is about our role as creators of our own universe. The other aspect of this that was incredible to me was the suggestion that we create as we think, that our intention has an effect on the world, that not only do we connect with this information source, but that we can somehow manipulate it, as Hal thought, through our thoughts, and that we are having a relationship with it, with every thought we have. I think what was really impressive to me about some of the information I found from people like Fritz Albert Popp was that we are information transmitters, sending and receiving information at every moment, and that we are some sort of ordering systems, it seemed. If we were so coherent and we have an attachment to this field, that maybe we have an effect on it. Maybe we have the ability to change things. And that really became the second half of my journey, and it's going to be the second half of my program, too, is just examining our human potential and how much effect we have on our world. How far could our intention go? How much could it affect? How far can our sight go beyond normal perception? And how far do we tap into the field? I also want to look at the whole idea of time and space, because what Pribram talked about, what Hal Puthoff talked about, suggested that there is no time or space. There's a greater timelessness that is just all information from all time in the field. The other thing that I started thinking about was, if all of life and information is available to us in a single moment, and we've got this huge web of connection constantly affecting us at every moment, and this dialogue between our frequencies and those of everything else, then maybe our human potential is only a glimmer of what it could be and has vastly more possibilities than what we're told by current theory. And maybe we have the ability to access this information from everywhere in the ecosystem all the time. And we just simply have to relearn how to listen. I also kept thinking about the disservice that current science inadvertently had done to us. The ideas of these scientists and the zero-point field hinted at all kinds of possibility for us as human beings. And all I could think of was that scientists, in holding on to Newtonian science as the final word on how our world works, had really set mankind back for many centuries and had eliminated any possibility of interconnection between all living things, and it had been a little bit like subtracting out God. So in our next session, what I'm going to be sharing with you is some explosive experimental evidence demonstrating that our human potential is much greater than what we're told, and that we have the ability to see beyond our five senses, to affect inanimate objects, living things around us, and to access information of all kinds, regardless of time or space. There's also some amazing information hinting at the possibility that many minds trained on the same subject at the same time magnify the effect.
Sounds True presents The Field, Session 2, with Lynn McTaggart.
The big question that I had at this point in my investigation was how far our bodies extended. And that was really what I was thinking about at that point. Did they end with what we always thought was our own isolated persona, or extend out so that the demarcation between us and the rest of the world was less clear-cut? I also wondered about what human consciousness was. If it did have these quantum field-like properties, how much of its influence could it extend out to the world? And were we affecting much more than just simply observing when we notice and interact with our world? And I also was left with the question of, well, how strong is this influence? You know, were we participating? Were we nudging things to certain ways? Were we influencing as we noticed? So to look further here, I had to really ask the question about our involvement in observing reality. And to look further in that, I had to start with an eccentric physicist called Helmut Schmidt. He was a scientist who worked at Boeing and had a free hand with research. And he had been very influenced by the work of J.B. Ryan, who had done a lot of studies into parapsychology. But what he was interested in was not parapsychology per se, but what it meant about human consciousness and the limits of our effect. He was very interested in Ryan's ESP experiments, and he thought, well, if somebody can access that information over time and space, then it must say something more about human consciousness. He was also thinking about some parapsychological studies of mind over matter, or the effects of the mind on the physical world. And he again thought that that might have something to do with a quantum process. Remember, at this point, scientists are saying that human beings don't have any quantum processes inside them. And Schmidt believed that these physicists forgot one very basic aspect of quantum physics, which is the involvement of the observer. As any quantum physicist knows, a real strange element of quantum physics is that reality is basically unfinished as we know it, at this tiny nethermost level of the quantum particle. Any quantum particle, like an electron, isn't actually a set something. It's like all possible selves, all at the same time. So it's a little bit like a thing looking at itself in a hall of mirrors. All possible possibilities exist all at once. And the only time it turns into a set something is when a scientist, observer, takes a measurement or actually looks at the thing, and then he stops it in his tracks, almost like catching a butterfly on the wing. And so it's a little bit like the quantum world is something like unset jello. That's the way I always look at it, and began to look at it in this investigation, that our involvement somehow gets this jello to set. So Schmidt kept thinking, well, consciousness must produce this order out of randomness, and that our act of noticing creates reality at its moment of attention. It's us who get this jello to set. Maybe reality isn't just fixed as it is, but it's fluid, and so it's open to some sort of influence. And I wondered about this information that Pop had come up with, that we were highly coherent. The highest quantum order known to nature existed in living things. So I started thinking of it as us being something like a tuning fork, resonating with other things at the same frequency. And maybe our tuning forks become infectious in a way and create a kind of domino effect on other things. So maybe we set a resonance frequency under certain conditions, and that gets other things to vibrate at the same frequency. So Schmidt told me about a number of the very rudimentary experiments he first carried out. He created probably the first random event generator. This was a computerized 20th century version of a toss of a coin. The most common random event generator is something like a computer with an image of cowboys and Indians that flash alternately. So about 50% of the time you get cowboys, and the other 50% of the time you get Indians. And because it's governed by a random quantum process, you get an image of cowboys pretty much 50% of the time and Indians 50% of the time when it's left to its own devices. So Schmidt wanted to see whether or not this random device could be affected by a human being sitting in front of it and sending an intention to change it one way or another, to change it to more cowboy images than Indian images. He created a little rectangular box with colored lights and buttons, and he had people sit in front of it and try to change the directions that the lights would come on. He found that in a significant number of cases, he could get his subjects to change the lights away from their random pattern to some sort of order, that there was some effect that human consciousness had on these machines. Now, Schmidt published his original studies using very gifted psychics. He wanted to maximize the effect on these machines. Word of his experiments filtered through to Robert John, who was then the Dean of Engineering at Princeton University. Now, John was once again a completely orthodox engineer who had nothing to do with parapsychology or psychic ideas. And he was amused, but not necessarily convinced, when he first heard about this through a student. But she was very persistent, and he kept thinking about this and thought, this is the way to do this. We'll soup up and refine the equipment. And that was what he could offer. He could also offer a program in an established university and create a quality program that would really look at this in a rigorous way. So he began what was called PAIR, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Center, for looking at mind's effect on machine. And he created a major research program, probably the largest of its kind, to look at how our consciousness can affect the world around us. So somewhere in my travels, I went down to Princeton, and I met with Bob John and Brenda Dunn. And they were an amazing pair. Bob John is an incredibly impressive figure. He's one of the few people I've ever met who speaks in perfect, complete sentences. And he's a real stickler for detail. So that was the real hallmark of their program. They created a program that was highly rigorous and that examined this under extremely controlled conditions. His partner in this research was a psychologist called Brenda Dunn. And John was very interested in looking at whether or not this was a capability not simply possessed by very gifted people, but by the ordinary man on the street. Brenda wanted this to be a very human lab and a human process, and so she created a real human element to their lab at Princeton. She had teddy bears all around, so if they had certain computerized equipment, she would put a teddy bear on top of it or a little frog or something like that to get people relaxed. She felt that if they were going to have an influence, they needed to be in a relaxed state of mind and not feeling like they were part of a scientific experiment. With his talents, Bob John created all kinds of amazing gadgets that were all variations on the same theme. They were all REG machines. One of them looked like a giant pinball machine on the wall, and it was a load of pins, and when he'd press a button, a giant explosion of large balls would cascade through these pins and fall randomly into certain gullies created by these pegs. It was the task of the observer participant who'd be involved in his studies to try to influence those balls to go into more of one side of the pins than the other. He created all kinds of computerized images using archetypal images to see if that affected people, whether or not they could resonate more with the equipment. He created pendulums that would randomly go back and forth a set amount of distance, and the idea was to try to influence them in one direction more than another. He had a fountain that exploded with water at a certain height, and the idea was to affect it that way. He even had a little movable gadget with a little frog on it that moved in a certain random pattern, and the idea was to get this little piece of machinery to come closer or further away from you than ordinarily. So with all of this equipment, it was all basically a random system measuring whether we could affect it in a set direction a certain percentage of the time. Now, the incredible thing about John and Dunn is that they just set about amassing a mountain of data. They found that these effects were so subtle, if you just did one study or a couple of studies of an individual, you wouldn't demonstrate much of an effect. But if you magnified this over hundreds of thousands of experiments and you plotted them according to standard statistical methods, you would find an enormous deviation from normal. And that became the hallmark of their program, to just amass this enormous database of evidence that without a doubt demonstrated that on a subtle level, our consciousness could have a powerful ordering effect on this equipment. Over 12 years and nearly 2.5 million trials, they found out that something like 52% of all of their trials were in the intended direction of what they planned, and about two-thirds of their 91 operators had success in influencing the machines in the way they'd intended. And this was true no matter what machine they used. Again, that doesn't sound like much of a percentage, that 2% difference. But when you multiply it and magnify it over 2.5 million trials, according to the scientific evidence, that statistical change is enormous, and there's no way it could have occurred by chance. The other interesting thing about it is they found that individuals and the sexes had their own signature effects. They found that certain operators had their own particular effects. They might send an intention to have more cowboys than Indians, and they'd get more Indians, but they would still demonstrate an effect. They also found with men and women there was a really interesting difference. With men might want cowboys, and they'd get cowboys. They had a very directed and exacting effect on the equipment in the direction that they specified. With women, when they'd send an intention to get cowboys, they invariably got Indians. Statistically, this was still an effect because it was moving this equipment away from order, but it was the very opposite that they intended. Nevertheless, their effect was highly profound. So they found that women would have an effect even if it was the opposite of what they wanted. The biggest effect of all was when you had a bonded couple together, a male-female partnership and a bonded pair. In that case, they'd both have an effect in the specified direction, and it would be a profound effect. So this may say something about our effect as men and women. Maybe women have more of an effect if we're not trying and sending an intention. And certainly that was the case, too, with some of the evidence. Women had a better effect when they weren't concentrating, when they were multitasking on lots of other things. And I don't know about you, if you're a woman listening to me, but I certainly know that in my life as a working mother, I am usually doing 20 things at once. What was particularly interesting about this material of John and Dunn's, and he realized this too, was that it really flew in the face of what we understand to be classical physics. One idea in classical physics is a thing called entropy, which is the tendency of things to fall apart and move toward chaos. Everything goes toward chaos and disorder, according to classical physics. A cup of coffee sits there and always grows cold. You drop a stone into the water, and the ripple it makes eventually stops. We always move from movement to non-movement, from order to chaos. But what he was observing with these random machines was that something about consciousness could turn this from disorder to order, from randomness to order. And so possibly the coherence of living consciousness could be the greatest form of order known to nature and something that could help to shape and create order in our world. Now, it's worth saying, too, that this wasn't just a human effect. There have been some scientists who have done some really interesting studies demonstrating that animals have the same effect on random equipment. A scientist in France took an REG machine, and he used it with baby chicks. Now, everybody knows that a baby chick, if it doesn't have a mother, the first thing it sees, it will imprint on, and that will become its mother. So he did this with these chicks. He imprinted them with this movable REG machine, and he moved it outside of their cage on a random course. It was just moving randomly, and he found that over time, the machine was moving closer to the cage. The desire of the chicks to be near their mother was an inferred intention that brought the REG machine closer to them. He also tried that in the dark. He put a little lighted candle on an REG machine in the dark, and little chicks don't like to be in dark. And he found that, again, they were bringing this machine closer to them in order to get out of the dark. I think the most remarkable thing about Robert John and Brenda Dunn's work is what it says about our effect on all kinds of exquisite processes in our lives. I mean, just think about one thing, which is our effect on computers. I mean, computers are highly sensitive pieces of equipment. And if we have these subtle effects on random event generators, perhaps we're having an effect on all the equipment that surrounds us in our lives, our cell phones, our computers, our portable equipment that we're carrying everywhere. All of these things could be affected by our intentions at every moment. I also was fascinated by the differences in the sexes suggested by their research. It made me think that maybe men and women have different kinds of intentions, and that the folklore that we have about men are from Mars and women are from Venus maybe has a basis in fact. And maybe not only our verbal communication is very different, but also our energetic communication is very different too. One of the big questions that arose at this point in my research was the nature of ownership of thought, where exactly our thoughts lie. If you talk to any neuroscientist, they will tell you that the mind is located in your brain. But I wondered, if that's true, how can thoughts or intentions affect other people? And is it maybe the case that the thought's somewhere else? Or is there such a thing as an extended mind and a collective thought? And does what we think affect not only inanimate things, but living things as well? At that point in the research, I was reading some stuff about some native Indians living in the Amazon and one of their practices, and it really called this to mind for me. They assemble every morning at dawn, and they share their dreams with each other. And the reason they do this is that they believe that the dream is a map for their waking hours. But the most important element of this was that the tribe doesn't believe that the dream is owned by the individual. They believe it is owned by the entire group, and that the person who's delivered this information is only the messenger or the vessel for the dream to come through. The other thing they think is that the dream is the true reality, and it's the waking life that's the imposter. And from that, I started to think about maybe this is what's really coming out in this research, is that the intuitive information that we're getting, that we have only a glimmer of, is really the truer reality. And that if we can learn to access this, then we'll have a truer demonstration of what is real. So I started looking around for a scientist who had done work on this, on living systems, and everyone suggested I speak to a fellow called William Broad. He was somebody living in Texas, and ironically, he had worked with Edgar Mitchell in the early 70s, right after Mitchell had come back from the moon. They'd even designed some studies together. But Broad had been fascinated by Rhine's material, too, and he felt what was important was to start looking at the effect of consciousness on other living systems. So he began doing what consciousness investigators call DMILs, which is direct mental influence on living systems. That was a whole batch of studies. And for any consciousness investigator, the easiest way to do this is to create a thing called the sense of being stared at. That became Broad's signature study, and it's a really basic DMIL study. What you do is you take two people and you isolate one in one room and another in the other room. You hook them up to all kinds of physiological equipment, but the most common is the kind you use for a basic lie detector test. It's a thing that registers your autonomic nervous system's reactions in terms of skin conductance. It measures your autonomic nervous system reactions. And when you tell a lie, you have a basic fight or flight reaction. You get nervous, and that is transmitted through the electrical conductance in your skin. And that gets picked up on this lie detector. So Broad hooked up a receiver in one room with this lie detector equipment, and he'd have someone else in another room. He had a little video camera on the receiver with a monitor for the sender. Every so often, the sender would have to stare at the receiver. And if the receiver felt it at that time, it would be registered as an autonomic nervous system reaction on the lie detector test. Broad found in a significant number of cases that indeed when the sender stared at the receiver, that it would be picked up by the receiver. So this said to Broad, and it certainly said to me, that a very basic intention, like staring, would be registered unconsciously in the body of the receiver. And it had an enormous implication. It said that our intentions can be felt in the body of recipients, even over distance, even when the person isn't consciously aware of an effect. And also, it said that this is being felt deep within our bodies. So Broad wanted to take this a lot further, and he began looking at all kinds of living systems. He started out with just basic things like blood cells, and wanted to see whether or not volunteers could affect those blood cells. He put them in a solution that would make them slowly burst, and the idea was for his volunteers to stop that process. Then he tried doing other things, like having volunteers try to affect the direction in which fish swim in, and he had a fun little one of having his volunteers try to affect gerbils in activity wheels, making them run faster. And in all of these cases, he found that human beings were having a significant effect, that when they intended for those fish to swim a certain way or those gerbils to go a certain speed, they would have an effect. Broad's material was some of the best conducted of all this DMIL studies, but there had been many, many others on all kinds of living things, from bacteria and yeast to rats, cats, and dogs, to human cells and enzyme activity. And in a hugely significant percentage of cases, it was found that people had an effect, and that this was just ordinary people who would be recruited to try out this ability for the very first time. Broad found that there were a couple of conditions that would magnify the influence. One of them was if the influencer was highly motivated, if it mattered to him, then it would increase his or her effect. He also found that people had a bigger effect on things they felt close to. So the smallest effects might be found in something like fish or cells, and then increase with experiments dealing with cuddly gerbils, and be stronger still when people were trying to affect human cells, and then be at their greatest when somebody was trying to influence another person. He also went on to do some interesting studies showing that people could have an effect on other people in terms of calming them down. So a calm person could calm down a nervous person, and focus, so that a focused person could focus an unfocused person. Very interestingly, too, Broad was one of the few people to look at whether your influence on somebody else was as great as your influence on yourself. And he found that your effect on somebody else was almost as powerful as your effect on yourself. And Broad also did one other interesting thing, too, which was to ask the question, well, if you can have a positive effect on somebody, what's the effect of a negative thought? Do you have a negative effect on people? I mean, there's been plenty of anecdotal stories of the so-called voodoo effects and plenty of folklore about effigies and things like that. So he actually put together a study that would look at whether or not we can block negative influence. He'd have one set of volunteers be the senders, and they would send a certain intention, and the receivers in another room would attempt to block it by mentally shielding themselves, thinking that they were surrounded by a wall or being enveloped in cotton or some kind of mental shield. And he found that this did have an effect. There's some other evidence that suggests that it isn't that simple, that we may have to work a little harder at shielding ourselves from negative influence. But it certainly suggested that perhaps certain mental conditions make you less open to influence than others. I wondered about certain conditions that made it easier for people to tap into this information. And certainly there was some suggestion in Broad's material that our ability to pick up these signals increases when we are deeply relaxed, and also if there's some kind of interpersonal connection. I also wondered, too, whether or not it was true, as people like Irvin Laszlo have suggested, that maybe when we're picking up this information, it's a case of that bandwidth that I was talking about earlier expanding. Maybe this is what occurs during so-called psychic experiences. We just tap into a greater amount of information from the field. In fact, there's even been the suggestion that children who have past life experiences aren't necessarily reliving a new life, but they're just picking up the wrong radio reception. They're picking up somebody else's life information from the field. I have children, and I remember when they were small, they had what would be considered hallucinations. They had LSD trips all the time, and that was just their ordinary imagination. And even brain studies of children find that they are permanently in a state of what would be considered light meditation, or an alpha state, as they call it. And so maybe this is the case, that they are permanently walking around with a wider bandwidth. One other thing that came up with Broad's material that I was thinking about was, if we are constantly in relationship with everything else, if we are affecting at all time, we must need a strong community of good intention to function well in the world. So I started looking around for an example of this, and I found it in a book by Dr. Leo Gallen about a little town in Pennsylvania called Rosetto. This town was amazing because it was a complete transplant of a small population that had emigrated from the same area of Italy. And so the people and their culture had been transplanted more or less in its entirety. And the town had a very kind of cohesive feeling of community. Rich lived cheek by jowl with poor, and no one was jealous, and everybody worked together and helped each other. And the fascinating thing about it was, despite the fact that they'd all adopted a standard American diet and lifestyle, you know, with high-fat diets, and they smoked, and they did all the things that you weren't supposed to do, Rosetto had a heart attack rate less than half of that of the neighboring towns. But then, about a generation later, this kind of cohesiveness fell apart, and the young people moved out of Rosetto, and they didn't carry on the same sense of community, and before long it began to resemble an ordinary American town. And suddenly the heart attack rate zoomed up to that of the rest of America. So it suggested to me that for that tiny bit of time, Rosetto had been coherent and had created the kind of interacting community that perhaps we all need. You know, we've covered an enormous amount of ground with some pretty complicated ideas. And it might be a good idea before I talk about the most mind-boggling stuff that I discovered on this journey, just to recap where we've been. The material that I found basically added up to a new paradigm of the universe. The material that Hal Puthoff had discovered convinced me that our life at its nethermost level was a dynamic cobweb of energy exchange, and that this field of information joined all of us in its invisible web, and that we are part of this information exchange, and we boil down to, at our most basic level, an energetic charge, that we're sending and receiving information all the time, and that the basic currency of the world is this relationship, this energy relationship, and that life exists only in a state of relationship and not as a state of separateness. I think you have to really try to take on board this idea of relationship, because everything in our lives is predicated on the idea of separateness. The Newtonian ideas that we talked about earlier that formulate our current worldview are predicated on separate objects operating in space according to set laws. And everything that we've discovered so far, that I was discovering on my journey, drives a stake into the heart of those ideas. People like Fritz Albert Popp demonstrated that we are all candles. We are beaming out a tiny current of light all the time. And this light is an information and communication system, not only inside of our bodies to relate one part to another, to direct the show, so to speak, but also between different beings, so that we're sending out messages that are constantly received and replied to. And not only our molecules are operating according to frequencies, but also our brains communicate through quantum frequencies and through an energy exchange with the zero-point field. The most outrageous idea of all is whether or not the higher cognitive processes in our mind are located inside our brain or whether they're out there in the field. The quantum pioneers that I talk to firmly believe that things like memory are not stored in the brain, but that are retrieved from the field. And also that when we die, we, in a sense, decouple ourselves from this physical body and re-enter the field. One of the areas that I kept wondering as I was coming across this amazing new worldview was what it adds up to. How do we bring this into our lives? How do we use this? I certainly thought we had to change the way that we think. We have to change the way we think of me and not me. You know, maybe there is no more not me. We have to change the way we interact with other human beings. We have to change the way we carry out our work, because right now it's predicated on separateness. We have to change the way we bring up our children, because we teach them to be competitive. We have to change the way we approach our death, because maybe we don't ever die. Maybe our energy just transmutes. So basically, we have to change everything. But how can we use this practically? That was the question I had. What do you do with this? And I think that was the question relating to all these scientists, too. How do you take this out of the laboratory? What can you use this for in real life? And to find out, I came across a little-known scientist called Elizabeth Targ. She was the daughter of a fellow called Russell Targ, who was very involved in psychic studies and in some studies that I'm going to talk about fairly soon. But she was a very standard psychiatrist. She came across some interesting and intriguing information that suggested that healing might improve outcomes with breast cancer victims. And so she started thinking that perhaps she should put healing to the test. And she looked at other studies of healing and found that although they were very provocative and they showed that distant healing worked, they weren't very scientific. And so she wanted to put together one of the most scientific studies of healing of all time. She put together a very ingenious study. I was fortunate enough to meet Elizabeth Targ, who was only 40 and very sadly died of a brain tumor, a very fast-growing and lethal brain tumor, shortly after she published the study. She was a remarkable woman, very traditionally medically trained, very skeptical, one of those people who demanded the proof, but also another explorer, philosopher, scientist, like many of the ones that I had met, who was open enough to a new prospect and open enough to try out an outrageous idea. So she decided to gather together healers of all types and to subject them to the supreme test of healing, which was to heal AIDS victims. Now, this was back in the 80s when AIDS was invariably a lethal disease. So she gathered together 40 eclectic healers of all persuasions all across America, everything from typical Christian healers to Native American shaman, and everything in between. She had people from the Barbara Brennan School of Light. She had people from the Joyce Goodrich School of Healing. She had people who were interested in chakra healing, in color healing, every type of healer. And she very tightly randomized this study so that half of the AIDS patients, who were all very similar at the same level of disease, were in the treatment group and half in the control group. These were all patients who were in end-stage AIDS patients. All had a very short period to live. And she very, very carefully created envelopes with their information. And all she gave these healers was their name, their photograph, and their T-cell count. So the healers had virtually nothing else. The healers also never met these patients. They were in locations all across America, and they never got in any kind of physical contact with these patients. Every week, they were given a new patient, and the requirement was that each of these healers were simply to spend an hour a day sending a healing message for the improved well-being of these patients and the improved T-cell counts and health of these patients. Hour a day in whatever discipline they used. And that included, for people like the Native American shaman, going out to a canyon and doing the classic pipe ceremony. And for others, it was praying to Jesus. At the end of her trial, Elizabeth was amazed to see that the patients who were prayed for were better in every regard. They were getting better. The patients who were not prayed for went ahead and died as expected. She was shocked by this and wondered whether or not there was something in her data that was wrong. So she made an even more rigorous study and she repeated it. By the time she repeated it, the new drugs had come out for AIDS, and it meant that AIDS was not necessarily an automatic death sentence anymore. She changed what she was looking for in terms of improvement and wanted to see if they would be better in different categories, better physically, better mentally, better emotionally. And again, at the end of her study period, she discovered that those patients who were prayed for were better in every regard. There was no denying it. This distant healing, which was being sent from places as far away as New York to the patients living in California, this healing was working. And she published her study, and it had an explosive effect. So it said to me that the biggest and most practical way of using this extended potential, our observer effect in the world, so to speak, is to send out positive intentions for health. But it also suggested to me a lot of other ways that we can use it in our life. If our intentions are having an effect, imagine a doctor. Elizabeth told me this, that as a psychiatrist, she felt that she could never see a patient again when she was in a bad mood, that she'd have to watch her state of mind whenever she was engaging in ordinary healing work. Imagine if you had a doctor who never saw patients unless he was in a good mood, who created a little healing space of his waiting room, who never said anything but a positive statement to people when he was diagnosing them, indeed, who never gave a negative diagnosis. I saw this, the power of intention, with my mother-in-law, with something similar like this. She had end-stage breast cancer, and she was too late for surgery or chemotherapy. She was an elderly British woman, and that generation just didn't complain. So there was nothing for it for us but to take her to an alternative practitioner, a doctor called Patrick. And Patrick was remarkable because he not only used alternative treatments, but he never believed in a negative diagnosis. Her breast at the time was basically raw meat. It was unbelievable. And when Patrick did an examination, I was in the room with him, and he just turned to her and very positively said, "I think we can handle this." And I believe that his positive intention was the thing, more than his treatment, that saved Edie's life. Her breast cancer turned around within a few months, and her ordinary doctor, when he did an examination, was speechless. All signs of her cancer had disappeared, and I believe it was down to the power of positive intention. I think that Elizabeth Targ's material was remarkable to me because it suggested as well that the power of intention is available to ordinary people as well, and that maybe we are little Frankensteins who have an amazing power over our daily lives. It all comes down to what our thoughts are all the time. What are we thinking? And our thoughts become our life's intention. So far, we've been talking about intention and the conscious mind having what they call psychokinetic or mind over matter effect on the world, that our thoughts are things that affect other things. But there are other implications of being able to tap into the field. And I started thinking about what they might be. You know, if we're in touch with everything at every moment, then we ought to be able to see things and get information at distant places. And that very thought led me back to Hal Puthoff, because I discovered that Hal had been one of the main architects of a massive remote viewing program that was eventually funded by the CIA. Remote viewing, you probably know, is a way of seeing without your five senses. It's a way of viewing something outside of your line of vision in real time. Hal came upon this by happy accident, too. He was trying to find out whether or not you could use quantum theory to describe life processes. He was kicking around the idea that if electrons had non-local effects, then maybe we could pick up information. Maybe we could acquire or receive information by long distance. And so he was going to play around with a little study of this involving algae, funded by his benefactor, when his proposal, which he sent to somebody in New York to peruse, was seen by a famous psychic called Ingo Swann. And Swann was fascinated by this and contacted Puthoff and said, "Okay, if you want to see about this, why don't you test me?" So Puthoff was very skeptical of the whole idea, but he flew Swann over to California, where he was at the Stanford Research Institute, And he said, okay, if you're so good, you tell me what's in that machine. And he pointed to a thing called a squid, which is a super quantum interference device, which measures the effect of just stray electrons going by. And a squid is usually wrapped up in a magnetic shield, and it's put underground with several layers. No one had actually even seen what the squid looked like. So Swan said, okay, and he proceeded to draw it. He drew it, and not only that, this machine, which had an output that was very, very regular, it sent out information on a piece of paper, almost like a wiggly line on an old lie detector test. And suddenly, the machine made a gigantic squiggle. Anytime Swan looked at it and said he was mentally going inside it, the machine registered on its output paper. So Putoff was intrigued by this and thought, first of all, no one has seen the insides of this. So he took Swan's drawing, he showed it to the person who'd created the machine, and the person said, yeah, that's exactly what it looks like. So Putoff said, right, let's try some more of this. And he began putting little things in boxes and asking Swan to remote view them. And that was the word they began using, remote view them. Before long, a couple of men in black showed up at Putoff's office and said that they were from the CIA and that they'd heard about the work he was doing, and he was exactly the person they were looking for, because the Russians, and at that time it was the middle of the Cold War in the 70s, the Russians had been using psychic means to spy on the Americans, and they were concerned about this and they wanted to find out whether there were any ways to spy back. So they began to fund what became a gigantic program stretching over many years to study remote viewing. Now, Putoff started with Swan, and he started with his little boxes, and then he created what became a remote viewing protocol. He would keep Swan in the office with his partner, another scientist called Russell Targ, and he would send a traveling partner out. And the traveling partner's job was to take an envelope which had a destination somewhere within a certain radius of Stanford Research Institute, and open it up once he got out of the building, and then go wherever it said he was supposed to go. And then the receiver, who was Swan, would have to draw and describe where his partner was going. Over time, the destinations became further away and more exotic. They tried doing remote viewing when Hal Putoff was on vacation. They tried sending their remote viewers hours and miles away, and they found that over a hugely significant number of times, Swan could correctly draw and describe where they were going. At that point, too, Hal's work came to the attention of a former police commissioner called Pat Price. Price contacted Putoff, and he said, do you know, this is exactly what I do when I catch criminals. I close my eyes, and I mentally see where they are. And I send my team, and invariably that's where they are. So Hal said, okay, and he had Price join the program. But now they decided to make it a little more difficult. They decided to give Swan and Price just map coordinates, the longitude and latitude coordinates, and say, here's a set of coordinates. I want you to describe and draw what's there. Swan and Price were so good that in a couple of instances, they actually breached American military security. In one instance, they both drew what looked like an underground facility, and Price in particular drew it in exquisite detail. He actually even drew the names of files inside filing cabinets and the desk plates of officers who sat at certain desks. Now, when Putoff got this material, he asked the person who gave them the coordinates if this was correct. And the person said, no, of course not. I only gave them the coordinates of my summer place. All they were supposed to draw was a little house. They got it wrong. But Putoff didn't believe it, and he had one of his associates drive to this place because he felt there was so much detail here. There must have been something they'd both picked up. And what they've discovered was that there was a secret underground facility here, and that what had happened was that Price and Swan had mentally scanned the area, found the little summer house, decided that wasn't important enough, and found the most likely important place nearby. And that wasn't exactly on the coordinates, but it was close to it. And so Putoff and all of his associates were questioned at length by the Pentagon for the security breach. The only way they could calm the agency was by giving it a bone and saying, right, why don't you give us the opportunity to remote view something you're really concerned about? And so the agency gave Pat Price some coordinates in Russia and said, remote view this. And Price came up with a remarkable remote view. He said he saw a special facility with a giant crane going overhead, and he saw enormous sort of spheres with wedges, almost like the pieces of an orange. And he saw people welding this together but having some trouble. Later satellite photographs and American intelligence discovered that at exactly the place Price had seen, there was indeed a Russian facility. And what was there wasn't a secret military facility that was trying to create something to attack the West, but a secret space program that was attempting to develop a spacecraft that would fly to Mars. Well, I mean, one of the questions I had, and Putoff answered it, was how far can we go with remote viewing? And Swan answered that with one really interesting challenge. He said, okay, give me some coordinates outside of the Earth. And so they did. They gave him coordinates in space. And he said, right, I think I'm seeing Jupiter with rings around it. And everybody thought that this time Swan had just got it wrong, because everybody knows that there are no rings around Jupiter, there are rings around Saturn. But later, when they looked at some special photographs in space, they found out that Jupiter indeed had rings around it at the time, and Swan was right. Interestingly enough, Putoff wanted to test whether or not he could shield this. So he tried electromagnetic shielding and even tried having a remote viewer be submerged in a submarine underwater, because water can effectively block out the signal if it's a straight electromagnetic signal. And the only waves that would not be blocked would be quantum effects. And he found that the remote viewer did just as well under 170 meters of water as he did on dry land. And it suggests that since every object is absorbing and re-radiating information from the zero-point field, the information would probably be re-emitted back through the other side of the water shield. So once again, the Putoff's information reinforced for me that what was going on with remote viewing was another kind of tapping into the field, which made it possible for us to be a bit like an electron being everywhere at once. One of the most amazing things about the information that I kept coming across was that it was completely independent of any normal causal effects. By that I mean an ordinary timeline. One of the basic features of life that we take completely for granted is that life proceeds in a forward-moving arrow. And we see this reinforced in every aspect of our lives. We order a cup of coffee at Starbucks and it arrives at our table. We send something through the mail and it arrives at its destination. We're born, we grow old, and then we die. That's the biggest feature of a timeline, is our own mortality. But none of these effects followed an ordinary type of timeline. They seem to work as well, whether or not they were absolutely out of ordinary time and ordinary space. And so it started to say to me that our ability to tap into the field moves outside of our ordinary notions of time and space. One of the most interesting examples of this had to do with remote viewing and a session by Pat Price. Pat was following the usual protocol of sitting in the Stanford Research Institute lab and having a traveling partner take an envelope and travel to the destination that was written inside. And when Pat drew where his traveling partner was, he drew a swimming pool with two tanks. Now, when the partner came back and the scientists compared his destination with Pat's drawing, they thought that this time Pat had just got it wrong, because although there was a swimming pool there, there were no tanks. But years later, after this, Russell Targ, who was Puthoff's partner in this, came across a Chamber of Commerce booklet about the area in question, which was Palo Alto, California, where the remote viewing had taken place, and he discovered a photograph of 50 years ago of that site. Now, currently, it was a community swimming pool, but at the time, it had been a community reservoir, and it had not only a little lake there, but two water tanks. So when Pat saw the scene, what he'd seen was not the scene as it currently existed, but the scene 50 years ago. And that suggested to me that when we remote view, we can pick up information backward in time. Now, at the same time that this was going on at Stanford Research Institute, Brenda Dunn and Bob John at Princeton were also carrying out remote viewing with Titan protocols, and they discovered that in a hugely significant number of cases, their remote viewers could pick out where their traveling partners were going, draw and describe where they were going, hours, if not days, before their destinations were even chosen. There were also time-displaced effects on REG machines. Helmut Schmidt created an ingenious REG experiment where he converted it, instead of having computerized images that would flash cowboys and Indians, say, he created a stereo audio device that would alternate sounds in the left ear or the right ear when somebody listened to it with a set of headphones. And he told his volunteers that what he would like them to do is send an intention to have more of one side play than another. So they would send an intention to have more left ear clicks than right ear clicks. When he played back these tapes, and remember they'd already been run out before someone listened to them, when Schmidt went back and listened to the master tapes himself, he found that indeed they did have more of a certain kind of click, a left click or right clicks, depending on the intention of the listener. So this was a bizarre situation because their output had already been generated. And Schmidt and I wondered what had really gone on here. And I realized that what was happening was not that people went back and changed what had already happened. Their minds had reached back down the timeline and affected something as it was being generated. They didn't change the past. They changed the present as it was unfolding. And they'd changed that output on that machine as it was unfolding. So this was probably the most challenging idea of all for me. How did this work? And I had to ask many scientists about this. Could we go back and change the past? And what was the mechanism that would allow these kinds of things to go on? Bob John said something to me that really encapsulated it when he said, take time out of it and it all makes sense. And that to me became almost like a little motto, take time out of it and it all makes sense. Some people tried to explain it as a physical mechanism, that in certain kinds of exotic physics, the zero point field can be condensed and some information travel two directions at once. And others said that because this is quantum information, everything exists as just one great big smeared out now. Or there were yet other theories saying that the future is enfolded in the present, almost like David Bohm's idea of the implicate order, which means that all information is hidden away and only becomes available or explicate when we need it. And that could even include when it's out of a typical time-space continuum. But then I would say most of the scientists working in consciousness research have an idea that the future acts on the present, that our present is contingent upon future conditions. And by that, we mean that it's not like we go back and change the past, but that our future and our present are constantly referring back to each other, that they're both in touch with each other, and that we have access to future information and it informs what we do in the present. And it may be that, you know, we're talking about quantum physics and electrons and things that exist as pure potential until observed. And there's a whole school of thought that feels that the observer effect works out of time. And so if everything exists at some bottom rung level in the realm of pure potential, if we're seeing into the future or the past, we're helping to shape it and bring it into being. And just as we do with a quantum entity in the present, with our active observation. So maybe we take time out of it, as Bob John suggests, by taking our own separateness out of it, because we create time and space ourselves in a sense. Through our acts of perception, we create an artificial sense of time, and we create artificially separate objects existing in space through this continuum. And so by creating time, we create our own separateness. And this also suggested to me that we had to create another paradigm to represent time. Instead of using the idea of an arrow, this unceasing forward progression, that maybe we would do best to look at native traditions that view time in a circle or view time as one present. And that idea can permeate everywhere in our lives. It can permeate the idea that maybe we can affect things in the so-called past through our present intentions. I asked William Broad about that because he'd done a lot of work on this area and he thought about it. I said, okay, so how much can we change? Can I go back and revisit all those areas in my life that I've had lasting regret over and change them? And he said something really interesting. He felt that the areas we could change would be those seed moments where, as he put it, nature hasn't made up her mind. And he meant areas almost like the branches of a tree before it grows into something big and static and unchangeable. Like the early part of an illness before it takes hold, maybe we could send our minds back to that moment and change our intention at that point, and it will affect everything that comes afterward. It sounds so counterintuitive, but it may be worth a try. It was clear to me after all these discussions I'd had with these scientists that our thoughts as individuals could affect our world. But it also begged the question, what happens if a load of people are thinking exactly the same thought at the same time? Does that magnify the effect? Is there such a thing as a collective consciousness that operates out there in the world? To answer this question, I started asking around whether or not anyone had looked into this, and I discovered a scientist called Roger Nelson, who'd been at the PEAR Lab working with Bob John and Brenda Dunn. And Nelson had started thinking about this idea of collective consciousness, and it was his idea to take an REG machine and just stick it in the middle of a group that was involved in some intense activity. He thought of putting it in the middle of very intense conferences or religious gatherings or even trying to monitor the effect of a very engaging thing on television. Another scientist called Dean Radin, who's a well-known parapsychologist, decided to test what would happen if these REG machines were going just at the point where the Academy Awards announced the winner for Best Actor, when everybody in America was at the edge of their seat watching the opening of the envelope. And he discovered that there was an effect on these machines when loads of people were thinking one intense thought at the same time. This prompted Nelson to put these REG machines all over the world and to work with a lot of other scientists to just have them going all the time and to measure what would happen at the moment when people were focused all over the world on a single thought. And usually that was the case when some global disaster had happened. He monitored these machines when Princess Diana died, and he found that there was a huge effect on them. And he monitored them when John F. Kennedy Jr. died. He found there was a huge effect. And those kinds of effects, even good effects, like the turning of the millennium, there was a big effect. But the greatest effect of all occurred during 9/11. And he discovered that the machines seemed to have reacted in collective horror. And so it suggested to him that there was a kind of collective consciousness that was present and reacting and affecting the zero-point field whenever there were moments of peak attention. Now, this begged the question to me, if this is true when we've got some focused attention, what would happen if all of us had an intention to have an effect? I looked all over the place for some evidence of this, and the only place I could find some was with the Transcendental Meditation Organization. They had looked at cases where their advanced meditators had sent an intention to lower the crime rate or to lower global conflict. And they had done very well-controlled studies, and there'd been some evidence that when people send an intention as a group, they would have an effect. What this said to me is that we can have a collective effect as well as an individual effect, that perhaps we can get together as small communities and send group intentions, and perhaps they will have an effect. And it's certainly something that I wanted to explore, the idea that group thoughts can also change the world. All of this left me with some powerful ideas about the power of thoughts and the power of choices we have to take now. If all thoughts are things that affect other things, then we have to be very careful about how we frame our thoughts. Our thoughts, individually and collectively, are going to have huge ramifications beyond our individual needs. They could ripple through the cosmos. And so it means we've got to investigate what it is we're thinking all the time, because how many of us have positive thoughts? And it also means that we're going to have to think about how we think about our loved ones. I mean, are we thinking positive thoughts about our children all the time? Are our thoughts creating our children? If we're thinking they're lousy at math, is that creating somebody who's failing math? And if we're thinking positive thoughts about our community, as a community, won't that raise the consciousness of that area? So certainly it gives us pause about what we should be thinking in our daily lives. I'd finished all of my research, and I was trying to figure out how to end this book, and also trying to figure out what exactly it all meant and how I was going to carry forward. So I went to a propulsion workshop, because Hal Puthoff was going to be appearing there, and it was my chance to really meet him finally. We'd had so many conversations over the phone, and we could finally meet in person. And I watched this amazing pioneer, and there he was, that phlegmatic little personality, standing there and talking about the future of space travel. It felt like a nice, neat metaphor for where we were going to, because he was saying that zero-point energy was probably the most promising model for the future of space missions and space travel. It also suggested to me that, like Hal, we were all explorers, really traveling into the unknown with this. I felt in my own journey the old paradigm had been demolished, scientist by scientist, and all of them had started out thinking and believing all of the tenets that were given to them as young scientists, that the human being is a genetic survival machine and a more or less a genetic mistake, that the brain is separate from the body and is the seat of consciousness, and that we are isolated from our world, that mind's isolated from body, and that time and space are finite universal orders. And with all of their discoveries, I realized that we'd put together a new paradigm that said something like this, that we are quantum beings, that all living things are connected by this invisible web, that the brain perceives the world through quantum frequencies, that everything is indivisible, and that living consciousness is not isolated. And in effect, there's nothing that is not part of this field. There's nothing that is not God. In a way, the field, I mean, many people have asked me, does the field counter religion? I don't think the field attacks religion in any way or replaces religion. I think the field explains religion. And you can talk about the field, whether you want to call it the zero-point field or a state of grace. It is simply a science of spirituality. When I wrote this book, I decided to dedicate it to my daughter, Caitlin, because when she was 5 years old, she's 17 now, when she was 5 years old, she was a wise little child. She used to meditate just before she went to bed, and she would sit there and pray and say, "I am not alone, I am not alone." And I always thought that was an incredible idea for a five-year-old to have, this sense of isolation in the universe. It might just be because she's a little Libran and she likes to have a significant other all the time. But I tended to feel that it was a sense of isolation that she carried with her. And I dedicated the book to her, and the line I used was, "You never were alone." Because I felt in my own journey, I had come to a discovery that the reality that we're now faced with, that is much more interesting and complex, is a life-enhancing vision to replace that separatist and bleak vision that we're left with in Newtonian science. The information that I discovered and that I put together, it made me understand that we are all far more than we realize, and we are never alone. We were always part of a larger whole, and that our intuition is correct. And that for the first time, perhaps, science can be united with religion. And that with all of us, we are all a Christopher Columbus, like a Hal Puthoff. Without a compass, we're all finding our way. But in a sense, this is a positive vision because our life is in our hands. So for me, many people said, okay, I believe this. So how do I live this? How do I live the field? And I felt that there were many things we had to do. We had to really ask a lot of big questions and tear down the old models of how we live our lives and learn how to use this expanded consciousness and learn how to expand the bandwidth ourselves and be in touch through other senses and start investigating how to operate without limitations of time, space, and dimension. Perhaps enlarge our definition of conscious thought and truly take on board what the ramifications of life without division could be. Because I suppose the most important point of all is, without separateness, there is no other. We never were alone. We always were part of a greater whole. The one idea I'd like to leave you with is the idea that emerges from all this science about the power of intention and what that really means in your life. It means that you are the co-creator of your world, of every moment of your world, that what you think at every point of your life is changing and making your reality. And that is an incredibly powerful idea, that you can go out and live your dream the way you want, that you can create your world, and that your life truly is in your own hands.
This concludes The Field with Lynn McTaggart. Music by Stephen McNamara. Thank you for listening.